Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 23, 2018. This is the week 3 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
The Buddha's very first teaching was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I love that word. And he gave that teaching to the five friends that he had met while searching for enlightenment, wandering around northern India. He had become estranged from them because he left them. He started taking care of himself physically, but they saw that as being indulgent to his senses, and they figured, well, we lost Siddhartha. He's not one of us. But a few weeks after his awakening, they notice Siddhartha, now the Buddha, walking down the street, and they notice this beautiful and powerful countenance about him. And as he got a little bit closer, they realized that he had attained what they were seeking all those years, that he had become an awakened human being, a fully mature human being. And these are the words that he said to them to describe his awakening. Vision arose, discernment arose, insight arose, knowledge arose within me of things never heard before. The truth of dukkha, meaning stress or suffering, the truth of dukkha has been comprehended. He's referring to himself. Now, I understand now the nature of suffering. It was commonly accepted and almost expected that men in the society of northern India, southern Nepal at that time, would at least spend part of their adult life leaving their home behind and looking for enlightenment. And there was all kinds of different ways that they would do that. Of course, not every male did that, but Siddhartha was one of them. And what he's declaring initially is that what everybody else is seeking, I understand it. And I understand it in a way that's never been heard before.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
As far as these five friends is concerned, and actually maybe the whole of the spiritual community in that time, were they also looking for the nature of suffering as Siddhartha was?
I'm taking a drink to give myself a chance to think about that question. Yes and no. In a sense, in a very broad sense, you could say that any type of spiritual search is a search for understanding what's missing, anyway. And what's missing is the feeling that I'm missing something in my life is stressful, is dukkha. So in that broad sense, you can. But in a more direct way, most all spiritual teachings from the beginning of humankind has been after the great questions, hasn't it? Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going?
Right.
Where did this all come from? And then getting into something that has misguided even Buddhism is, what's the nature of the universe and are we all one? And so those are the common questions that drove every spiritual seeker during Buddha's time and during our time. I mean, you've heard me talk about the different suttas where those great questions are put to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, forget the questions. It's your questions that are confusing you. And answering those questions does not lead to the goal, meaning the Buddha's goal of understanding the nature of suffering. They're just distractions. In fact, this was something I was going to talk about, but you got me right to it. The thinking about those big questions, who am I? Do you notice the I making in the question? So even the question itself is, no matter where you take it, is going to lead to more distraction and more delusion. Where am I going? Where do I go? Where do I go when I die? All of that is seeking to establish a self in a realm that in my present state of understanding, I can't grasp. But I'm concerned about it because I want to establish a self in everything that I can think of, including where I might have come from in the past and where I might be going. I got to fit myself. I got to set myself up in the past and the future because this is all I have. When you believe that, your mind is rooted in ignorance. What the Buddha teaches is that what you are is something that is always in a constant process of becoming. So you can't point to a permanent self yesterday or tomorrow, can you? When you try to, you're just distracting yourself and you're furthering your own delusion, and you're using that as a very powerful but subtle strategy to continue to ignore your own ignorance. Does that answer your question? Somewhat. So the Buddha was unique in, at least in that approach, that he had a very well-focused direction. Remember when he left the palace ground for the first time in his life, he saw sickness, he saw aging, he saw death, he saw poverty, he saw competitiveness and aggressiveness in the townsfolk. These are things he never saw. He was 29 years old now. He had lived a life up until that point of incredible luxury and a purposeful luxury. The Buddha thought, I mean, the Buddha's father, King Suddhodana, I can't think of his name right now. Suddhodana, thank you. Thought that if he could engage in Siddhartha's every wish, give him everything he ever wanted, Siddhartha would never think of leaving the palace grounds. Didn't work. In fact, at a very early age, young Siddhartha was so unfulfilled with all this lavishness in his life that caused him to start wondering, what's the point of all this? I have everything I could ever want, and I'm not happy. And so again, he left the palace grounds and noticed sickness, aging, death, the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of people. And that so shocked him. And it really was, at least the story is told, that when he first saw a dead man on the side of the road, he asked Chanda, who was his attendant, he says, why is this man sleeping on the side of the road? And Chanda says, he's not sleeping, he's dead. And the Buddha, or Siddhartha, didn't even have a context or understanding that. He said, what do you mean he's dead? He said, he's dead. He said, everybody that gets here is going to die at some point. And that really is what shocked Siddhartha into the right direction. If we're all going to end up like that, what the hell's the point? I don't think he used that word hell in his own self-talk. What's the point of this? Why are we so overcome with satisfying ourselves and beating other people and getting more than other people? Why do we insist on establishing our own views? Meaning, I mean, the Buddha was well aware of the wars and the conflicts that were taking place during his time. The Buddha's time was just as violent as our time is today. There was really no substantive difference. In fact, really the only difference was the instantaneous global communication that we have. Everything else was about the same. So the Buddha set out to understand if there was any way to make any kind of sense out of this. If we all end up like that poor guy on the side of the road, what's the sense? And along the way, we create such suffering for ourselves. So he left and he wandered around northern India for 6 years. And so to get back to your question, the difference was the Buddha was looking for something much more basic, wasn't he, than to answer the grand questions. He wasn't care about where he came. He didn't care about where he came from or where he was going. He wanted to understand the immediate nature of his life. What's going on right now? Who am I right now? Not who am I tomorrow or what happened to cause me to be this way. Who am I right now? And so, I could tell that story for, I could go on and on, but I'm not going to. So that leads to what I wanted to start tonight's talk with. Again, I answered your question, the big difference. So the Buddha awakened after this search around northern India, studying with the foremost so-called spiritual teachers of his time, Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta, who both taught what they proclaimed were very advanced teachings based on the Vedas, different variations on the Vedas. The Vedas were the precursor to modern Hinduism. The Buddha studied with both of these teachers, and he mastered their teaching very quickly. He mastered their meditation techniques very quickly and told them both, this is not it. This is not, you're not teaching what I am seeking understanding of. And so he continued to wander around northern India. He started studying engaging in very, very extreme ascetic practices, which really grew out of the Vedas. The Vedas were the common influence to all of northern India at the time, and even influencing the Jains, which were a common religion during the Buddha's time, that are still existing today. There's still Jain sects around. with very major differences between what the Buddha eventually taught, what the Vedas presented, and what the Jains still practice. After all these years of arduous study and very physical ascetic practices, denying his very physical needs, he was eating one bean or a grain of rice every day as part of this ascetic practices. The Buddha tells in one of the suttas that he could feel his backbone through touching his belly. He was that emaciated. And he was walking down a street one day. He passed out, rolled into the edge of a river, and a young girl, the legend is anyway, Sujata, saw him and pulled him out, saved his life, and nursed him back to health with some milk and rice. When he regained his strength, he realized that that very extreme ascetic practice wasn't the way, denying his own very human existence. And from his experience growing up in his father's kingdom, he knew that extreme sensory indulgence, getting everything you want, is not the way. In the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha describes his awakening very clearly as getting caught up in this feedback loop of self-referential views, meaning what I need to be happy, bouncing off of or reflecting off of a wrong view of self. And that kept him rooted in ignorance. Not understanding who he was in relation to the world because he lacked a fundamental understanding. He was ignorant. Right? That's what ignorance means. So the Buddha awakened to something that's called dependent origination, which means that that dukkha, suffering, originates in and is dependent on a certain condition, dependent origination. That condition that the Buddha realized that led to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences was ignorance. Ignorance of the way things really are. And if you think about that, before you can do anything, if you want to go change a light bulb and you don't understand the nature of it, you can't do it, can you? Even though it's a very simple task. And you're either going to, by your own wits, figure it out, or somebody's going to teach you, you know, you first got to unscrew it this way, then you put this one in that way, and then you got light. Well, the understanding of the Dhamma is the same way, and being ignorant of the Dhamma is the same way, because you've never, in a general way, because you've never studied it, or nobody's ever taken the time to teach you, how could you know it? And so if your understanding of light bulbs only goes so far as to candles, even though you might have a house full of light fixtures, if you only understand candles, you're going to spend your whole time in your house lighting candles, aren't you? Simply because you don't understand how to flip a switch and put a light bulb in. The Dhamma is the same way. There's nothing wrong with being ignorant of the Dhamma because nobody pointed out the light switch yet. But then the Buddha did. So the Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it was ignorance, very specific ignorance of four noble truths, that led to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. So his very first teaching then was that Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where he established the Four Noble Truths for the very first time. So the first noble truth is that dukkha occurs. Now remember what I'm saying is that dukkha occurs because of ignorance of the way things really are. So the declaration is, going from the assumption that ignorance is present, because ignorance is present, dukkha occurs. The second noble truth is craving for and clinging to originates and perpetuates dukkha. Craving for what? Because of a lack of understanding, the initial craving is craving for self-establishment. Because I don't understand the nature of self, what constitutes a self. Out of that ignorance, the only thing I can do is to, this is me, and to hold on to this. And because that me is rooted in ignorance, I don't understand the nature of impermanence of all things, and the nature of me always being in a process of becoming, then I'm going to spend my life protecting, defending, and promoting me, one individual, fixed-in-place self. And once that ignorance is established through craving, then I can only cling to these false notions of self. Does that make sense now? Dukkha occurs because of craving for a self-referential existence, and once I establish that existence in my mind, I cling to those views. That's the essence of wrong views or views rooted in ignorance. The third noble truth says, and it's, to me it's the most important truth, and it points directly to to anicca, to impermanence, is cessation of dukkha is possible. Cessation of unsatisfactory and disappointing experiences, distracting experiences, ignorance is possible. The Fourth Noble Truth is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, is the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the Four Noble Truths. Everything the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years of his life, his entire teaching career, was taught in the context of dependent origination and that very first sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Noble Truths. This is a very singular and very specific Dhamma that the Buddha taught, didn't he? He didn't teach an all-encompassing cosmic worldview that would marry every type of spiritual thought into one thing, which is a common push today. In fact, many of the great Buddhist leaders say that the point of all religion is we should find some common ground. It's not going to do it, because there is no common ground. We should allow religions to stand on their own and respect them for what they are, rather than insist that we create some kind of pasteurized, homogenized, single worldview that can only contradict what the Buddha taught, which is to see things in their discrete essence, to not be so compulsive about creating a one world or unified view theory, that everything has to fit. Because think about that. Who decides what that view is, what the one world view should be? Me. And if it can't fit into my view, then I'm going to discard it or I'm going to adapt it in some way. That's the nature of ignorance, isn't it? We change things and adapt things and accommodate things to fit our views rather than what's really occurring. That's really the essence of what the Buddha realized. The problem is conditioned thinking rooted in ignorance of the way things are. So how can we develop a way of understanding these four truths? How can we develop a way to understand the nature of our own unsatisfactory experiences? We need a framework. And again, pointing back to the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path that begins and ends in right view. And I'm not going to review the whole Eightfold Path because that's next week, but this leads to it. When the Buddha describes right view, he doesn't describe it in any magical or mystical or esoteric ways. He says right view is a view that comprehends, and I'll add the words, at a very penetrating level, dukkha. An awakened person understands the nature of suffering. And out of that understanding, another way that the Buddha described an awakened mind or an awakened person is that person is released from clinging. Another way of understanding dukkha at a profound level is letting go of that very craving and clinging that brought up distraction and suffering in the first place. In fact, another way the Buddha describes an awakened human being or an arahant is that they have released that very craving and clinging that leads to dukkha. So the whole point of the Dhamma then, and again, it's important to remember, this is a very specific teaching with a very specific goal, to understand and empty ourselves of ignorance. And the Eightfold Path is the framework for taking our thinking that from a mind that is rooted in ignorance to a mind that is rooted in wisdom of how things really are. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose. Discernment is a way of, another word for understanding or wisdom. Knowledge arose within me with things never heard before. That's remarkable, isn't it? This single human being, through his own efforts, through his own right efforts, figured it out. And more importantly than that for me, for this selfish self, is he then spent 45 years teaching others, including me, how to do the same. And that leads to the last thing I'll talk about. If that's the case, if that's really what I believe, and it is, from a lot of experience, why would I want to change it or alter it or cloud it or embellish it in any way? And the Buddha taught me how to do that by keeping things framed by the Eightfold Path. And then what I can engage in is a direct path to awakening, to full human maturity. The only thing I have to do, which is something I never was really good at in my whole life, is pay attention. Pay attention in a very specific way. Another word for attention is mindfulness. We've gone through a lot in this past 6 months. We've gone through the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, so you know where I'm going with this. What to hold in mind. Again, the Eightfold Path is the framework for what to hold in mind. And without that framework, a mind that is rooted in ignorance will hold in mind anything it can to continue to ignore its own ignorance. So that's the importance of being focused on the Four Noble Truths. What I'd like to hear from you tonight is, from that chapter you read on the Four Noble Truths, do you see that as the entire context of the Buddhist teachings, and how are you relating that into your life? So that's fair enough, isn't it? Before I go around the room, any questions specifically about what I just talked about? Did it make sense? Frank?
No.
Please tell me why.
It doesn't happen like that for me. It's not like a systematic, like dukkha, like the first, second, third, fourth truth. I don't know. Like when I try to look at my life that way, it doesn't unfold like that. And it's not how I experience cessation of the suffering. I don't know. I don't even know if I could explain it. It's more like through clinging and craving, suffering arises. Mm-hmm. But I'm not always sure what causes the clinging and craving, because it's not always ignorance of Four Noble Truths, because I understand and have right view of Four Noble Truths, but it's through that sixth sense base where I have contact and self-referential experiences that these cravings arise. And it's always seeking outwardly to satisfy the mood that I'm in.
I don't mean to interrupt you. Please say that last line again. I'm seeking outwardly.
Yeah, that's like I'm in a mood. So then clinging onto or craving something that's going to relieve the mood.
Yes.
Or whatever it is that I'm in. But I'm not in ignorance, because I'm understanding what's happening to me, and it's not until I practice that fourth noble truth that I feel cessation. But it's pretty much keeping that whole Donald wheel in motion, and it's not real easy.
No, it's not. Thank you for describing the Four Noble Truths in a very practical way, because that's just what you're describing. The reason why I asked you to say that line again is that it's the essence of eye-making to see that. And that's the insight that's gained as we develop the Eightfold Path. So in a very direct way, you are describing integrating the Four Noble Truths into your life.
Well, I understand it's eye-making.
Yep.
It doesn't make you go away that.
Oh,
it doesn't disappear.
Yeah, that's that. Well, it simply means that there's more to develop.
Yeah, so you have just telling you you're not there yet.
Yeah, you have a little ways to go. That's all that means.
Yeah, but like along that path, I mean, there's also a life that has to be maintained.
Yep.
That is in the phenomenal world. That is with other people and in a business, and I can see why the monastic life is very attractive. Two men who have children and wives and all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah.
It's like, why not?
It's a great escape.
You know, it's like that mountain stream and
So the Buddha realized all those things. It's one of the reasons why he called the Eightfold Path a middle way. It avoids the extreme views of extreme asceticism or complete sensory indulgence. It allows us to be human beings and live human lives, meaning even as a business owner or a part of a family or even part of a larger organization. We do these things. That's what human beings do. He didn't teach a Dhamma that you needed to be removed or disengaged from your humanity. In fact, when you start developing the Eightfold Path, you realize that you have been disengaged from your humanity in a big way up until that point. And as we deepen our mindfulness and deepen our concentration, every aspect of our life has a meaning to it. And we are, in a true way, connected through mindfulness of everything that's occurring, without clinging to it, without eye-making.
I could see in those experiences where if I practice some principles to help me engage in life without the clinging and craving.
Yeah.
Helps speed up the process of being able to let it go. I've never really been able to volitionally let something go. More like letting it be. It's not like I can just make a decision and say, I'm going to let that go. It's like out of grip on me sometimes.
Yeah.
And I have to practice something else that helps me not allow craving to get to gain a grip on me.
Yeah. And again, that's all what you're describing right now is an aspect of a mind that is deepening in concentration because you're able to see these things and developing right mindfulness to see things in relation to right view, to see things clearly. Ill-will. Again, that's all aspects of Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path.
Ill will pops up in my mind a lot when that happens.
Yeah.
Because I'm usually dragging somebody through the woods in my mind.
Yeah. Again, thanks for your honesty. That's you know, and that again, ill will is something to be recognized. Remember, it's to be recognized not as a sin that you're going to be punished for it. We recognize ill will because it's hurtful towards ourselves and towards others. And we recognize it because we know that when we are, we're having thoughts of ill will, even towards ourselves or towards others, it's because of a misunderstanding of who I am. It's I-making. It's the essence of what the Buddha is teaching. So thank you for bringing that up, Frank. Any other questions about the talk? And we'll go around the room. Scott. How are you? This is your first time on Tuesday night, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, so Scott's been coming on Saturday. So welcome to our Tuesday Sangha. How's your Dhamma practice going?
It's going good. I like the idea of the way the Four Noble Truths blend into the Eightfold Path. That to me is amazing. I never knew that happened. I've read Buddhism. I've never been to a class before. So I never put that together. And I think that's great, the way it works. But I also have a question about the word anatta.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Anatta. A great point and a great question. Let me just reference that first one. I was studying modern Buddhism for many, many years. I took my vows in a particular Tibetan religion, and I very, very rarely even heard the words Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path is a fourth noble truth. It's remarkable that you can be that as you have been involved, or I was involved in Buddhism, and never hear the most important teaching the Buddha ever taught. Again, that's why, that's why I talk about these subtle but powerful strategies that we will develop to ignore our own ignorance. Even in modern Buddhism, you're often not even taught what the Buddha actually taught. Anatta is one of the three marks of existence. That's anicca, impermanence; anatta, the not self characteristic; and resulting dukkha. Those are the three marks, meaning the three experiences that everyone that has a human life will have. We carry those marks. We carry those experiences. Anatta was a common term during the Buddha's time, but the Buddha used it in a very different way, much like he used the word karma, which was common, but he used it in a different way. The Buddha used the word anatta to make the point that, and usually anatta is, in modern Buddhism, is said to refer to no self. There's no such thing as a self, and in fact, whole Buddhist religions have been built on that, that there's no such thing as a self, the self is just empty and all this, and the Buddha never taught anything like that. The Buddha used the word anatta because it was common of his time, but to point out the difference between what he was teaching and what was rooted in the Vedas. And he used the term to say what you think of yourself is a wrong view of self. It doesn't constitute a self. It's not a self. Let go. In other words, think about it. The picture that we have of ourselves, if it's rooted in ignorance, is not a self. It's not a real self. It's not an accurate view. Let go of the view. And that's what the Buddha meant by anatta. And that's why it's important to remember the use of that term, too. So, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. It's an important question. And it's one that comes up often, especially when we're starting to look at the authentic teachings, because there's a real meaning to understand what constitutes a self, and that it's not just nothing. If you think about the idea of creating a strategy to ignore ignorance, the best strategy of ignorance is a quick strategy, something that leads me quickly to ignorance. I don't have to think too much about it. So creating a doctrine that there's no such thing of a self, then I don't have to think about it anymore, do I? It's not worth my consideration because it's not even there. Of course, the Buddha taught it as a central tenet that we should consider deeply, not ignore. So thank you for bringing it up. Ron, good to see you tonight.
See everybody. I'm surprised how how much I've gone through from complete ignorance of the Four Noble Truths when I first came here to a lot of confusion about it. I think especially the first one. Does this mean that there's only suffering? And I try and research that more, and it just leads to more confusion.
Yeah.
But reading what you've written over and over again, finally, you know, the hammer on the rock, finally, gets me
through
to the point where I'm starting to see where this is going. But it's been a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, but I'm starting to get comfortable with the view that we get to this suffering just because we don't understand the way things are.
Yeah. Specifically, the three marks of existence, but. Yeah.
It's, of course, again, much easier to see that in other people than but it's nice to have those examples right in front of you.
Well, it is. If everybody else would awaken, I wouldn't have to bother with it. But. Thank you. It does take, it takes time. It takes a lot of repetition, which is boring. I mean, that's another reason why a self-referential ego self has such a difficult time with it, because it's boring. At least at first, unless you can generate rapture, meaning joyful engagement with the Dhamma, then it's not boring anymore. Then it's exciting.
Wrong views of the Four Noble Truths is another big chunk of it.
Oh, it's a huge chunk. But that's when, like, someone like Russ or Scott or anybody that's starting fresh, it's not, it hasn't been influenced by a lot of modern spiritual teachings.
Right.
I mean, always finds it easier.
It's
because you don't have that aspect of conditioned mind to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
To say, well, it's not. We create such strong beliefs, especially when they're so-called spiritual, because those are the most powerful self-referential beliefs we have. I mean, we fight wars over those religious beliefs, don't we? The reason why we do is because we have such a strong self-identity over them. And that, of course, they're very difficult to let go of when we're looking at something different. The Buddha dealt with that problem all through his teaching career, and it came up at the very first Buddhist council about a month after the Buddha's passing, and then again at the second Buddhist council, where a definite split was made between the Sangha at the time, from people that wanted a more religious-oriented Buddhism and one and that group that wanted to keep it to what the Buddha actually taught. And that was the beginning of the... That sect was called the Mahasanghikas, and that led to the... formation in the third Buddhist council in a very strong way of Mahayana Buddhism as opposed to the original Buddhism. So that same motivation was always there. Thank you. Christine, good to see you tonight. How are you?
You know, I'm picking up more and more. I reread the reading, you know, and one thing I can say is, you know, I'm still like learning, still piecing things together, but I have noticed that throughout the day, throughout the week, I catch myself being like more mindful and you know, I don't know, just being more conscious of, you know, what is going on up there throughout the day. So you know, I'm really, really enjoying this process.
Wow. Thank you. I mean, that is worth the price of admission, isn't it? And really what you're describing is just being mindful of what's occurring in your life. But what a powerful thing to do. And to realize that until we really engage in the Dhamma and start reclaiming our own mind, we are really living a deluded existence. Because we're never present. We're always distracted by what we want, what we think we need to avoid, where we might be going. How can I continue to establish this insatiable ego self in every thought, word, and idea that occurs? It's stressful. That's why dukkha is stressful. So when we start integrating the Dhamma, even initially, the rewards are great. And it's so important to... excuse me. It's so important to recognize... the benefits of it too. Because that keeps giving... Excuse me. I get so excited I stop even thinking about it. Recognizing the benefits keeps our focus in the right direction, doesn't it? Good for you. Glad you're here tonight. Mary Beth, good to see you.
A little bit like Ram was saying, you know, like over time, not nearly as long or with nearly as much attention and study as you, Ram, but like that, you know, my experience tonight is interesting that certain things just, I heard so many times and that just really stand out. And one of them is this idea of ignorance, the ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. I mean, you know, I'm like a dollar for every time I've heard you say it. But I just had a moment when you were talking where I just imagined, like, it just, I got the clarity of, like, and the whole circle of it, like, I just had this image of the Buddha, like, really getting how absurd it all is.
Yeah.
And how it is the ignorance, and, you know, to what you were saying, Frank, like, it was almost like, and I'm quite sure I won't hold on to this, but it was like, for an instant, I had, like, I really got what it meant, as opposed to intellectually. Mm-hmm. Like, I, you know, I've been around and heard it enough. I have, like, grappled with the meaning of it enough, or at least enough of it, that I feel like I intellectually can, you know, listen to you and kind of get how that all fits together and, mm-hmm. you know, sorted through some of the, like, wait, you're saying, no, it's this, right? But there's just that moment where it just, like, it really is all absurd.
It is.
It's like, it's none of it's permanent, and it really is that we just can't see it. And, you know, even the question, because I'm going to sit closer up now, because I like looking, like, from back there, I can't really, like, read this, and I, like, as you're talking, listening, and reading, and I don't know, it's just some, there are moments, this, like, little instance where it all sort of, you know, I get it at a deeper level. Yeah, and even all, you know, the other thing was what you were saying about, you know, who are we right now? Like, who, like that idea of, like, getting to see, like, really, who am I right now? And the just the idea of that is interesting, and it helps me to see, like, how much I'm looking ahead or looking back. Even that, like, trying to figure out, like, why am I the way I am now? Like, I guess a certain amount of that work is useful, but like, I don't know, that's just one of the things I'm going to take on for myself, is really trying to have that awareness of when I'm, you know, drifting into worrying about this or that, or, you know, and, like, well, what if I just, like, you know, seek to have a greater clarity on who I am, my brains, in this moment. And that's all.
That's really the essence of it, I guess. What is going on right now? And not even in a sense of an analytical. It's, am I present with my life, in my mind,
yeah, right,
in my body, right now? Because that is the answer. That is life's greatest reward, to be present for your own life, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a mind that is rooted in ignorance is constantly distracted from what's occurring in the present moment. It sounds so simple. I'm sure to some people it sounds like it's not even worth, why even consider that? Why don't you just go live your life and have a piece of chocolate cake and forget it? Because you're missing your life. And in missing your life, you create a lot of stress and disappointment. That's the reason why we do this. And it's important to hear things over and over again. You know, that's how we learn the Dhamma. And the reason why is because a conditioned mind has this veil of ignorance. And things gotta keep passing through that veil until that veil finally drops away and you see things clearly. You hear the same thing that you've heard, you know, for 3 years, and tonight that little bit about ignorance made sense. Or it made sense on a very profound level. And that's how it is. So thank you for sharing that. It's how it is for, I think, everyone. I mean, I remember a lot of aha moments after many, many years of you know, all kinds of Buddhist practice. And I honestly can't tell you I had an aha moment in any of those. And people do. But I didn't have any aha moments, so I started studying what the Buddha taught. And then I had a lot of them, including being exposed to the Four Noble Truths for the first time as the Buddha presented it. It was like, this is something I can do. I didn't quite understand it yet, but I understood at least that a human being actually taught this, not some mystical god or goddess or somebody that I need to appease in order to gain awakening. He left me the rule book.
But, and if I can say, John, I mean, what occurs to me is that you understand it well enough to not lose sight of it and be distracted, which is what I feel is the huge gift you bring to us. Because I imagine you must have your own moments of ignorance and whatever, you know. But
not me.
But,
never.
Sorry. But
I am not that way.
But you get it deeply enough that you can keep that clarity and the focus, and you have that commitment, and then you just keep bringing it to us and keep saying it over and over again so that we can penetrate enough to get through. So thank you
for saying that. It's through the Dhamma that I was able to develop a mind that is concentrated enough to incorporate the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, and I'll take credit for doing that. But that is based on what the Buddha taught. And the only reason I am so enthusiastic about this, not just here, you know, you should see me on a street corner on Sunday, is because I know it works, and I've seen it not just in myself. I mean, I see it every, you know, three times a week. I'm lucky to see it within our Sangha as you're all developing the Dhamma and listening to your incorporating it into your life and the changes that it makes. I mean, it is exciting. And it's honestly, it's the only thing that I've seen that has had a useful and effective impact in a very real way on people's lives. And that, you know, I got a pretty narrow focus, so I'm be missing some of that. But it really works, and that's exciting, isn't it? You know? Sure. Thank you. Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Greg. Mary Beth and Greg are from the Raritan Learning Cooperative. They're our ongoing Dhamma project, and we have a workday coming up there. March the 4th?
Sunday, March the 4th.
They need some painting.
Or window washing,
yeah. And a few other things. So I'll put that in an email, maybe get a flyer up. But hopefully you can join us and support. I mean, it's just a great school to even call it a school, huh?
Yeah, learning cooperative.
Yeah, it's really great what you're doing there.
So, you just describe it a little.
Oh yeah,
sure, yeah. Absolutely. It's a full time learning. We call it Learning Cooperative Learning Center for 12 and up, like teenagers, kind of a high school alternative. And the key is, it's what we call self directed education, where the kids, rather than being some set curriculum, we support them in developing, you know, different ways of learning and, you know, just what they want to learn.
So it's an alternative school.
It's an alternative to school. Only because alternative school people think of something very different and specific. It's, you know, kids that come from, you know, there for all different reasons. Mm-hmm. They're bored at school, they want to be something, you know.
Thank
you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a cool center. It's a big old Victorian house. So.
You have some open houses coming up too, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can always, if anyone, and a lot of the teaching happens because we have all these kids with all these diverse interests, and we bring volunteers in to teach all kinds of stuff, so if you wanted to, you can stop by or talk about your career for an hour and meet some cool kids, or come once a week for an hour and teach a class, or just come by and say hi to us. You know, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday are our main days. We're out in the world sometimes too, which is another cool part of what we get to do.
Where is it?
It is on Main Street in Flemington, corner of Main and Church Street, big yellow Victorian house.
Yeah. If you're interested in just talking to the kids about what you do, it doesn't necessarily have to be your profession. It could be something that you're interested in, you like to share with kids.
Absolutely. Anything. I mean, I'm looking at Ram going, oh, right, we lost our Dutch teacher. But Ram works full time, doesn't he? you know, anything. Spend an hour, you know. They have, you know, such. Anyone know anyone who is a train conductor or dispatcher? Kid who's like, stuff about trains. Yeah, and it's.
I know someone. I think he's in New York during the week. I'll ask him.
Yeah.
He comes here occasionally too on Saturday.
Well, we'll take a trip there. That's how interested this kid is. So
take the train.
Thank you, Mary Beth. March the 4th. Greg, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I have been, I was sick for like 2 weeks. Just not feeling, good. But I have been following online, so I haven't really missed you as much as you miss me.
We have missed you. I'm glad you're here.
The Four Noble Truths, I read somewhere a long time ago that basic structure was used, you know, before the Buddha in like medicine, and it read like, you know, there is disease, this is the cause of the disease, what am I missing? Yeah.
There is the disease.
You can cure it. It can be cured. This is how we cure it. I don't know. I'm missing something. Oh, yeah. And then the cure is, you know, so medicine. So that structure was used, you know, previously, and that the Buddha was probably familiar with it in that context because he, you know, was very wealthy, had the greatest teachers you can find, and the massive, you know, being able to apply that to suffering. In such a big way, and then maybe not that no one had attempted that, but then that he actually found the Eightfold Path, and that, you know, it actually works, was like the big, you know, breakthrough, I guess. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, the Buddha is often referred to as the great physician because of that metaphor that he diagnosed a common human problem of suffering and the cause of it, you know, much like emphysema is caused by too much smoking, usually, that the cause of dukkha is craving and clinging, rooted in ignorance. So he prescribed the, and then he prescribed a solution following his diagnosis. The solution to emphysema is usually to at least quit smoking, you give yourself a chance. The solution to ongoing craving and clinging is to develop the Eightfold Path so that you can recognize it and put down the cigarettes.
And I think seeing it that way changed a lot for me, because often when I'm sick, I'll know what I need to do, what I should do, what works, and I'll forget to do it. And then someone will say it, and I'll be like, oh yeah, I know this. Like, why didn't I do that? I've done it before, it worked, and then for some reason or another, I just find some reason not to do it. And
that you choose to ignore it. And that's the essence of ignorance.
Yeah, yep. I feel like the Eightfold Path, I've made ways, I've always found a reason to leave off, you know, one or two pieces of the eight, and then the disease doesn't get fully cured, or the, you know, the dis-ease, the suffering, and it would be like the greatest doctor you have access to giving you free advice, access to the medicine, and you say, well, I'll, you know, save these two out of the eight pills for later. You don't take it.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. And that way of seeing it really changed a lot for me and made me kind of commit, you know, very recently since coming here fully to all eight. Or closer. You know, I still have sometimes, like, I don't know, seven. But
we've already asked which two
you're day to day, man.
It's just that way, Greg. The as you start diminishing the power of a self-referential ego self of anatta, it still wants to hang on to a little bit and come up with more. Well, just okay, if you're gonna get into the Eightfold Path, do six. And we'll be okay then. Then you can keep me and you can go ahead and awaken at the same time. It doesn't work. The Buddha taught, because he understood all those games, and upon his awakening, this is, to me, the brilliance of the man. He understood all the games we play to keep ourselves in dukkha. And he taught a very specific way to solve that disease, the disease of anatta, the disease of self-making. And he put a guarantee, just like a good doctor would say, here's the problem, this is what you did to cause it, this is what you do to bring it to cessation, to end your disease, and you'll be healthy, and if you do it, I guarantee it. And the Buddha said that in the Satipatthana, the Anapanasati Sutta. He said, remember the part where he says, and if you do this just this way perfectly for 7 years, or 7 months, or 7 days, or even
What am I saying? 7 hours.
Even for 7 hours, you'll awaken. You got to do it. But he presented it just that way. This is the problem. Do this and you'll be well. And he also said, one of the phrases that he used, the wise know the danger, and even the slightest, well, use the word variation in this. And that's what I keep coming back to, this very specific teaching that he gave and a very specific way of developing it through a right meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, with the right intention and the right framework. And again, he gave us that. You mentioned something, that the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is something that he referred to as something never heard before. In the Nagara Sutta and other suttas, he refers to that. This is something that he realized upon his awakening, considering how can I teach people to overcome that common problem of conditioned thinking? How do I pierce that veil of ignorance? Through the Eightfold Path. It's just that. So, thank you, Greg. We're going to have too long of a class if I keep talking, so I'm not going to. Hi, Margaret. Good to see you.
So I do have to... Repetition is what's helping me. Every now and again, there'll be a moment of clarity. And I see it, and then it gets muddled again. But I've been having fun. It is easier to see these patterns in other people. So I haven't had any fun with that. But also in the in stressful conversations, like in a meeting at work, just seeing how the stress is created by the participant's unwillingness to let go.
Yeah.
Self-referential ideas or opinions, and that when you do it, it sort of ripples through the room.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are I making contributes to the suffering of others?
But when you stop that yourself, mm-hmm. you notice that it kind of influences the.
In the same way.
Yeah. It diffuses a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, even just practicing right speech in a situation like that is often just sitting quietly. And that allows the whole room to calm down, at least a little bit. And at the very least, you're not contributing to the stress in the room. And it's just that way. And it's true in any environment that we find ourselves in. And one of the great benefits of true refined mindfulness is we can have that effect by just practicing the Dhamma on our family and on our larger community. It really works that way. Thank you for sharing that and being here tonight. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. I've been thinking a lot about impermanence and that lovely Lao Tzu quote in the chapter, once you understand impermanence, you can let go of everything.
Yeah.
So I've been practicing that. I have a lot of big decisions to make right now, and I was holding on to a lot of things, feeling like these were the things I needed to decide to keep. And so I'm just trying to practice, what if I didn't have any of that? Mm-hmm. What if I gave up everything? And in so doing, some of the things that I really need have come to me. Some of the things that the way that I thought things would go has changed yet again. But I'm just trying to take that as, okay, so it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It's going to be something else. And I'll just wait as things unfold. But I'm just trying not to be set on any particular outcome. And just... go with the unfolding. So that's the big part that resonated to me, was really deeply understanding impermanence. And even in my meditation, as Lorna talks about often, just not just really recognizing the rising, but the falling, or the going away, or the, you know, your breath comes, your breath goes, the thought comes. And when the next thought comes, at least acknowledge that the last one left.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to, through my meditation, recognize all of the moments of impermanence and appreciate the impermanence that's short and dealing with the impermanence that's long when you'd rather it was short. Yeah, just kind of being present for that, those changing moments.
Yeah. It's so profound. Thank you. There's such peace and freedom in understanding impermanence, isn't there? No matter what's occurring. Kind of change. It's the nature of the world. In fact, you could an aspect of a mind rooted in ignorance is a mind that believes in permanence, including the permanence of its own self. That's where the problem arises.
And a beautiful visual is anyone who's been able to walk along the river, you know, this winter. Every day the river is different.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a great metaphor for impermanence. Impermanence and uncertainty. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, John. Good to be here with everyone. The Four Noble Truths is really reiterates the importance of deepening our concentration, of being like and living it through, Buddha said, being ardent, aware, and mindful of what the Eightfold Path, and for me, and then that is what's leading to wisdom, off your cushion. So that's what I've been thinking of. But the Four Noble Truths is the beginning, and then, as Liz often says, it all keeps swirling around and in on itself. It's not linear, it's not cyclical, it's because then it comes back again to being about deepening your concentration, which is the meditation component of the Eightfold Path. But then it's being aware of all the components in the Eightfold Path, holding that in mind versus anything else you can keep in mind, and living that off the cushion to arrive at wisdom, and then do it again. Swirling out, but that makes a lot of sense to me this week, because I was studying and thinking about the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah. It's just that way. It's very specific, and yet the truth kind of pervades everything in that way. At least as we start integrating it into our lives, that's the essence of right view, seeing things from that right view, from that perspective. Thank you. David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. Every morning I use your guided meditation, and your very last thing you say is, enjoy your practice. Mm-hmm. And that gets me through all the reading and studying and confusion, because you should enjoy.
Yeah, you should.
Like you say, isn't it exciting? It's exciting. It's, I don't know where I read it, but they called, when you get off your cushion, that's your field work.
Yeah.
You're taking what you're learning and what you're getting during your meditation and that spaciousness, and you're taking it out into the field.
Yeah.
And that's what I take out of the Four Noble Truths, is, the excitement of, here's a cure.
Yeah.
So, greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And it is that way, too. This is the cure. This is really what we've been looking for. It's what motivated the Buddha, and I think it's why we're here. We want to understand. And that's what the Buddha teaches, understanding. Thank you. Keila, good to see you.
Good to see you, Tim. Short, because I know we're behind.
No, don't say what's...
I think part of the teachings are that we're not supposed to hope, but yet I find the Four Noble Truths bring so much hope.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a hopeful teaching that it's inspiring to me.
Yeah. Thank you. And it should just be that way. Hope, it's okay to hope for that, for awakening. There's a word, Chanda, which happened to be the guy that the Buddha was walking around with, that means skillful desire. You know, so it's that skillful desire. It's a lot like that joyful engagement. You know, it's skillful to desire awakening. You know, there's no I making in that type of desire. Well, it might be, but it doesn't matter, because at some point you'll let all those wrong views go. Glad you're here. Say hello to the lady again. Try to get her. Russ, good to see you tonight. Welcome to our song again.
I don't have any great words of wisdom.
You don't need it.
But I will say that one of the things that's appealing to me is that it's something you can actually do.
Yeah.
You know, and you can invest in and ultimately get a lot out of, you know, immediately in your life, which is being present. You know, my work, and you spend a lot of time trying to make things happen, make outcomes come, so you don't live in the present very much. So I like that aspect of it, and just starting out, so looking forward to getting into more.
Yeah. Thank you. Everything the Buddha taught is practically applied. Yeah. He taught a Dhamma so that we can enhance our moment-by-moment human existence, and let go of anything that might take away from it. I'm glad you're here. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you for being here. I get emotional just being appreciative that when you're here every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, that you have that kind of devotion. I think something I aspire to myself is that kind of devotion, even in my own life. But thank you for that, for loving enough. I leave Friday morning at 6 o'clock for Boulder, Colorado to take care of my grandson while my granddaughter is being born. They don't know for sure, but she's due the first, and this is to let me get there a little bit ahead of time and get my feet wet or whatever. And I work at this job here in New Jersey, and I told them my son initially made the reservations for me to leave on last Saturday, the 20th. And I'm leaving the Friday. This is a story, by the way. I'm not telling you my life. Anyway, I am. But sometime last week, I said to my son, I said, you know, and we discussed this together, they didn't need me this week, and I said, I think I'm just going to not tell work that I'm not leaving, that I'm going to take this week off and just get rested up so that I can be rested, because I'm not 21 anymore. And so I did that. Well, and I told all of my clients that I was leaving Saturday. Everybody knew, and I live in Milford, and nobody ever comes around Milford. And I began to look at this and think, you know, is this something, where does this fit within the Eightfold Path and what I'm doing? Because it felt kind of deceitful. And but it was taking care of myself and all that yada yada. So anyway, today I got a call from the company, and sure enough, one of my clients called and wondered whether I was going to be there, and or whether anyone was going to help them out, because she knew I was leaving and not here. So RestCare called me, and fortunately, it went to the voicemail, and I caught it. And Friday afternoon, this past Friday, I took my time sheets to the office and dropped them off with a letter that said that I was leaving the 20th, and that I would give them a call when I was ready to return to work after the 9th of February. And I was glad I did that. Some kind of nudged me to do that. And I thought, after I got that call from Esker, I really started to feel guilty. Like, I can ignore this and not do anything about it. Or I could call and I could lie And I thought, when immediately right speech came to mind, and I thought, no, I don't want to do that. And I'm telling you, the virtue and wisdom that comes through just even the faintest awareness of these eight truths on the path. I didn't want to lie. I didn't want to really deceive. I thought it was okay to take care of myself in a healthy way. I didn't feel that much guilt about that. So I decided, you know what, the heck with it. I'm going to call him, and if I need to come clean, I can come clean. I have no guilt about taking care of myself in this way. So I called him back, and immediately she started talking, and she said, we got your letter. We know you're in Boulder. It's okay. We've got you covered. Don't worry about it. Thanks for calling. And that was it. I hung up. So I just, to me, that's the stuff working. And it's not magic or anything like that, but it's working in me.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, often the Eightfold Path is just a practical and gentle reminder of how to behave. And it leads to great freedom when we know that we're acting within the framework of the Eightfold Path. We don't have to think about anything else; just act accordingly. So thank you, Liz. Good to see you tonight.
And I say, once you stick your toe on the path, there's no going back.
Yeah. I don't think there is.
So with the Four Noble Truths, the way I see it is the way Mary was talking about it, where you can catch yourself. Or when you catch yourself anywhere along the way, you can recorrect. And through the skillful use of the Dhamma, you can shift your direction and straighten things out. And through kindness towards yourself, acknowledge that this is simple but not easy, and you always have something to sort of go to. You can go to any one of the eight elements. You can go to any one of the Four Noble Truths. You can go to, you know, dependent origination. There's so many ways that you can educate yourself and develop the skill at any point, even if you've been off your cushion for a couple days and you want to rectify that. So it's such a useful way of living and rewarding, you know, when you are. You can feel the difference when you're following all the elements of the Eightfold Path. You find yourself in that moment where you might normally not use skillful language or have a right view or whatever, and you take the time in that moment to kind of redirect. And you know, you can see the shift, like what Margaret was saying about being in the room, changing your own self-referential actions, and then sort of see the difference. And it's not magic. It's a different way of operating through life, and it's good.
Yeah, it is good. it's a true refuge that we that we take with us. And it's there for us in any life situation. Thank you for pointing that out. Bonnie, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm good. Everybody said a whole lot. I just think just the process helps me to be present. And the more I can be present, the more it affects everything. And every will never come in conflict with, I think. So.
Thank you. Great class. The The fall retreat, the registration is up on the website, so you can... the spring retreat, May 17th to the 20th. There's info on the website. I'll send an announcement out, I think, just a separate announcement out on Sunday or something, but you'll get that. If you're going and you know you're going and you can sign up, do it. The sooner you do it, it helps me greatly with the planning and the logistics. The sooner, I know it's a ways away, but if you know you're going and you can sign up, please do that. Next week we'll study the beginning of three weeks on the Eightfold Path, and we'll start learning about how that's integrated into our lives. So you'll read that first week on that. I think that's it. We'll finish with metta as we always do. Any other questions about tonight's class and the Four Noble Truths as the context for everything that we're learning? Okay. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, just be mindful of the arising and the passing away of your breath and your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Thank you all who joined online. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.